Good evening, Vancouver. I am Alex Lenz, and you are listening to UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. UBC Happy Hour is a collaboratively produced show made by the UBC Affairs Collective. So we're a group of students dedicated to producing content for this show, and our show is all about what's happening on UBC campus. So if you like what you hear and you like to help make this show, or if there's something happening on campus that you would like to see covered, you can send us an email at ubcaffairs@citr.ca. As per usual, we have a really full episode planned for today's show. So in the first half of the episode, we're going to be joined by Ryan Patrick Jones, who is a member of the News Collective here at CITR, which produces the show Democracy Watch, and a Master's of Journalism student at UBC. He's done a piece on male-led initiatives to engage men in conversations about masculinity, consent, and sexual violence. And then we're going to be hearing an interview that I did with a friend of mine, Caitlin Salvino, which is about a student-led policy initiative that graded campus sexual assault policies across Canada. So yeah, that's going to be the first part of the show. And then in the next half, we're going to be talking to the AMS about their Rent with Rights campaign that's aimed at securing tenant rights for students renting on campus. So just before we begin the first portion of the show, I just want to warn listeners that in the first approximately 25 minutes of the show, we will be discussing sexual assault. We will be focusing on the policy aspects of sexual assault, but if this topic is triggering for you, we would invite you to tune back in for the second portion of the show. So first off, we're here with the lovely Ryan Patrick Jones. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
So do you want to kind of just give listeners a brief introduction to your piece, and then we'll hear it?
Yeah, so basically it was produced as part of my course at the University of British Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. I published it on the thunderbird.ca, which is our digital news platform. And basically it just it goes into some examples of men on campus coming together to talk about masculinity, consent, and their role in stopping sexual harassment and assault. So I spoke to Cormac O'Dwyer from the Healthier Masculinities Program, which is run by the Sexual Assault Support Center on campus. And I spoke to the president of the Interfraternity Council. So he's the president of, which is the governing body for the fraternities here. And I also spoke to a UBC grad who is starting an unusual experiment, or like a social enterprise, he calls it, to basically target men and to show them that, to try and convert them to feminism in a sense. So I hope you enjoy it.
Nice. Okay, let's hear it.
The recent Me Too campaign brought public discussions of sexual violence to an unprecedented level. Thousands of victims have shared their stories on social media and beyond. But some argue Me Too places too much responsibility on victims, the majority of whom are women, to tackle a problem that statistics show is mostly perpetrated by men. Cormac O'Dwyer believes more men need to take the initiative in dealing with sexual harassment and assault. He is the coordinator of the Healthier Masculinities Program at UBC, a project for men that runs out of the Sexual Assault Support Center. Here's O'Dwyer.
So we kind of have this discrepancy where, you know, the majority of perpetrators are men, but men aren't getting involved in anti-violence work and anti-sexualized violence work on campus.
Healthier Masculinities is one of a number of initiatives underway at UBC's Vancouver campus, trying to get men engaged in conversations about masculinity, consent, and sexual harassment. Activities include workshops, sessions on consent, and discussions about what it means to be a man. While many women are speaking out about sexual assault and harassment, including at a rally held in downtown Vancouver last month, men have been less vocal. O'Dwyer is trying to change that. The Healthier Masculinities program runs two monthly workshops on campus that facilitate discussions around masculinity. Let's Talk Masculinity is a monthly public forum open to people of all genders and identities. Here, participants engage in wide-ranging discussions. As of November, Healthier Masculinities launched the Men's Circle, a new initiative for anyone who identifies as masculine. It is a rare safe space for men who want to learn about sexual consent or talk through their past mistakes. The promise is that men can participate without being judged. This is something that women working in the field think is necessary. Shiloh St. Cyr is the manager of the Sexual Assault Support Center.
There's no real resource on campus for them to deconstruct their toxic masculinity and to kind of work with taking responsibility and accountability. And so that's kind of where this kind of program grew out of.
At these workshops, O'Dwyer encourages men to recognize that they are part of a system that privileges their gender and that they benefit from it. And in some ways, they contribute to it as well. As such, men have a responsibility to take action.
If you're, you know, a man walking around this world, you might have a lot more privilege and opportunity to speak up in situations where other folks might not. And if you start to take the lead on doing that, then you might be opening doors for other people to also be able to have those conversations.
So right? It's like a slow change of the culture that will only take place through many, many individual actions.
I think so. That's where we're at.
Fraternities at UBC are also working to change. Jariah Newman is the president of the university's Interfraternity Council. He says that teaching members to understand the rules of consent is critical, especially in situations involving sex and alcohol. Here's Newman.
Creating that culture of consent is very much ingrained into the new member recruitment process that we do have.
Newman says that frat members actively encourage each other to call out their peers when they make derogatory comments about women. Part of this includes older fraternity members, including the presidents, leading by example.
It's not easy. It's not easy to call out one of your friends when they say something derogatory about a woman or say something that just is completely inappropriate. But if you see that, you know, if you see that your friend has done it, and then they still have their social circle or whatever, you know, you might not be so afraid to do it.
That was Newman. This March, he introduced a bylaw requiring all fraternity members to complete mandatory workshops run by the Campus Sexual Assault Center. The workshops cover sexual consent and train fraternity members to become active bystanders by taking action when they see a friend in a dangerous position. Despite the new bylaw, fraternities have been slow to follow through. Only 3 out of the 10 fraternities have completed a workshop this year. Newman points out that it will take time for new social norms to develop in the fraternity community. At the same time, Newman wants to push back against the reputation that fraternities have for being high-risk environments for sexual harassment and assault, saying,
I would not say that the issues in regards to sexual consent and harassment are unique to the fraternity system, but they are unique to young men on campus.
Newman hopes that young men everywhere will take this issue seriously. There's another, very different approach. One UBC grad is turning to technology to get men interested in the issues. In addition to educating, Reza Hushmand is recruiting. Hushmand is the founder of Bearded Feminist, a fledgling social enterprise dedicated to promoting gender equality. He is inviting men to become feminists through a combination of education, training, and community events. Here's Hushmand.
So we exist to promote gender equality. And the way that, how we're going to approach that is we want to recruit outstanding men to feminism. And what we're going to do specifically is celebrate authenticity, wisdom, and leadership.
The Bearded Feminist Project is one of the latest additions to a startup incubator program at the university called Entrepreneurship at UBC. His social enterprise, in keeping with others like it, will be run as a for-profit company, but will reinvest the profits into the cause it has taken on. The company wants to create a pay-what-you-want digital media website that produces content showcasing men who challenge traditional gender roles.
What we want to do is start celebrating authentic, wise leaders who we're calling bearded feminists, men who are confident in their masculinity. They don't feel like they need to overcompensate. They are not threatened by women. And we're just going to tell their stories of how they're aware of these things, how they are a feminist, and their life is better because they are a feminist.
The Bearded Feminist website is set to launch this month. Bearded Feminist will also attempt to tackle gender discrimination in the workplace by consulting with companies to create gender-balanced workplaces. This social enterprise is an unusual experiment in its early stages, so concrete actions are in the future. O'Dwyer, of Healthier Masculinities, knows that these kinds of initiatives take time to grow. Angela McDougall agrees. She has been working in Vancouver with sexual assault victims for more than a decade and now runs Battered Women's Support Services.
we don't have a very robust community of men that take action consistently. Not consistently. There are men that would be willing to speak about it if you ask them, but there's not too many men that are going to, in that way they're more like silent bystanders. There are not too many men that are putting themselves out there in Vancouver.
O'Dwyer thinks things will improve if more men begin to reflect on their past behavior and think about the role they can play in influencing a cultural shift towards healthier forms of masculinity.
You know, like, I think you kind of need to look around and see that violence and harm is happening. And so someone needs to do something. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a position where you can do something, then I really urge folks to step up and do that, right?
Whether or not these initiatives at UBC will be able to achieve their goals is an open question. But the efforts of these three men demonstrate a growing feeling that men also need to be a part of the solution to gender inequality. Ryan Patrick Jones, CITR, Vancouver.
Okay, so we are back live in studio. This is UBC Happy Hour. And you just heard from Ryan Patrick Jones on his piece regarding healthier masculinities and conversations around consent on campus. So we're here with Ryan now. Hey.
Hello.
So Ryan, what inspired you to cover the story?
Okay, so last month, I believe it was November 4th, there was a Me Too rally in Vancouver in the square outside of the Vancouver Art Gallery, and I was covering it for the UBC. And while I was there, one of the speakers, she was an Indigenous writer and also a survivor of sexual assault. She said to the men in the crowd specifically, which there weren't very many of, and she basically called the men out and she said, "Men, this is great that you're here. Like, thank you for coming. But what are you going to do about it tomorrow? What about the next day? What kind of action are you going to be taking?" And so that really stuck with me, and it got me thinking, what are men doing about this, right? Because, the Me Too movement was very much in the news, and it was, but it was very survivor-centric, and it seemed to me to be placing a lot of pressure and responsibility on them. And I was just, I hadn't heard very much, I hadn't heard of much activity coming from men specifically. Especially because, as I mentioned in the piece, the majority of perpetrators are men. So that's kind of what got me thinking about it. And then I started looking into examples on campus.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. So the Healthier Masculinities Workshop,
mm-hmm.
I was personally intrigued when I saw their posters around campus. And I had never really seen an initiative like that, actually in general, but definitely not on campus. So I'm wondering, do you know what the attendance is like at these workshops?
So basically, they have two different workshops. The first one is called Let's Talk Masculinity. This is a public event available, open to anyone of any gender identity, male, masculine, non-binary, what have you. And anyone can come in, and they basically have very wide-ranging discussions on things like health and masculinity or... and so these discussions are kind of open to the public, and they might get a bit more political. At those events, they've been going on for about, I believe, 2 years or so. As far as I know, they get upwards of 30 people at these events. They're monthly. The second type of workshop is called Men's Circle, and that's a brand new initiative. So I don't know if they have that much attendance yet so far. But I think they've only had... They just had their first last month, and they might have had one this month as well. But you know what happens during exam time, right? So I think attendance kind of fluctuates during those times. But the men's circle is a lot different. So the men's circle is only for people who identify as masculine. And the reason is because it's a much more prescribed space where people are encouraged to talk about their personal experiences a lot more. So whether that has to do with trying to figure out what it means to get sexual consent, what that means in reality. It can also be a sort of confessional space for men who have maybe misbehaved in the past to kind of work through their guilt and their shame. And so it's a feminist space. It's an anti-hate, anti-prejudice, and also anti-judgmental. So they're quite different. And I think, just because you have 30 people coming to one of these workshops doesn't necessarily mean that it's effective for those people. So I think something like the men's circle, where it's a lot more personal, it would actually be better maybe to have less people come. But
mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems like such a great idea. I guess my only kind of doubt would be like, it, you know, if it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, like men who are already feminists and already kind of believe in that mentality are maybe more likely to go than, you know, men who are like more likely to be perpetrators of violence. I hope that that's not the case. But yeah, I guess that would be kind of my only like question. But yeah, it seems like a great idea. And I think the posters around campus are at least putting that idea out there, you know, even if people aren't going to the workshop. I think that the posters do a really good job of kind of planting that seed of thought in people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to get, you know, how do you engage men? I mean, like, that's the problem with a lot of social issues is how do you get people to care about this? How do you get them to interrupt their day and to start thinking about it deeply? And so, yeah. But I mean, the fact that it does exist, I think, is very helpful. And it's definitely a start.
Yeah. So speaking of engagement, the, you know, Me Too movement was, you know, fully a social media, you know, like that was its origins was through social media. And I think social media obviously played a huge role in this whole kind of campaign that we've been seeing across the internet. So are any of these like healthy masculinities or bearded feminists, were any of them kind of using social media? I guess bearded feminists is planning on doing that, but was that like a trend that you saw at all? Or
Well, I know that so Healthier Masculinity is run out of the Sexual Assault Support Center. So the Sexual Assault Support Center has their own Facebook page, and they're definitely posting content related to this issue on a regular basis, promoting their events, these kinds of things. But I don't think there's any sort of, you know, specific campaign related to the Healthier Masculinities program on social media. In terms of bearded feminists, so they are the social enterprise that you know, is going to be creating a digital media company trying to convert men to feminism. I definitely think social media is going to be a big part of their strategy, especially their outreach strategy. A lot of what they're trying to do is to showcase examples of what they call authentic, wise leaders. So these are men who are comfortable with their sexuality and their masculinity, and they're not afraid of being calling themselves feminists. And so I think social media will definitely be a big part of what they do. But as I said, they haven't launched their website yet, so right. that's coming in the future.
Yeah. So, and then the fraternity portion of it. So I think it sounds really great that the training sessions are mandatory, but not great that not only three of them have done it so far, considering it is mandatory. So what do the training sessions actually consist of?
So from what I understand, a bylaw was passed by the Interfraternity Council, and it was spearheaded by Jariah Newman, who is the IFC president. And the bylaw stated that all fraternity members in the 10 fraternities must complete a mandatory workshop with the Sexual Assault Support Center every year. So what that means is that they go into the Sexual Assault Support Center and they do a 1 or 2 hour workshop. And I believe it will cover things like sexual consent. What does that mean? Not only the consent, but then it will also cover things like what does it mean to be an active bystander. I think it will also try and drill into them an understanding that of what rape culture is and how a lot of, you know, we need to kind of change the way we look at the world and to realize that there are aspects of this rape culture, or maybe, you know, that we do live in a rape culture. So I think those are the kinds of things that the workshop will cover. It is quite brief, and, you know, there's only so much you can do in 2 hours. But I think, yeah, it's definitely a good step, but it's definitely a little worrying that only 3 out of 10 have completed it so far this year.
Yeah, yeah, it is. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And yeah, that was a really great piece. And I'm really happy that we're seeing more of this movement around campus.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I just want to say, I think it's very important for men to start thinking about these things and to start getting involved. I know that me personally, I'm thinking about it a lot, and what I can do to reflect on my past and to what I can do moving forward. So I would encourage the men who are listening to do so as well.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So yeah, I mean, moving on to kind of another interrelated topic. So UBC's sexual assault policy. So UBC has a sexual assault policy in place. It's available online if you want to check it out. It's completely transparent. But there are aspects of the policy that could definitely be improved. And there is an organization that is trying to do that for all the sexual assault policies across Canada. So I got to interview a really good friend of mine from high school, Caitlin Salvino. We're still really good friends. She's an awesome person. She is co-founded a campaign called Our Turn, which came up with a system of grading campus sexual assault policies. So basically, campuses across the country received a grade for their sexual assault policy. So, like, you know, a 75% is like a B, whatever, just like a school grade would be. And then in addition to that, they were also given recommendations as to how they could improve their policies. And then schools that signed on to this and received a grade are going to try to be like improving their policies based on these recommendations. So UBC is a part of Our Turn, and spoiler alert, our campus's policy got a B+, which is actually the second best in the country. So Ryerson got an A-. Ryerson's in Toronto. Yeah, they received an A-. But yeah, there's so much room for improvement across, I would say, all policies. So yeah, I sat down with Caitlin to talk to her about Our Turn and find out why student voices are so critical in campus policymaking. So we actually did this interview a few months ago. It was in the start of October when Our Turn was officially released. But yeah, we're going to be airing it now. Yeah, you can find the Our Turn Action Plan online as well with how they came up with the grading system. And yeah, and then all the scores that schools got. So yeah, let's hear what Caitlin has to say. So we are joined today by Caitlin Salvino, who is a dear friend of mine and who is the chair of Our Turn. So Caitlin, what is Our Turn and how did it begin?
So Our Turn is a national student movement to end campus sexual violence. It's essentially a 42-page action plan that student unions have signed on to, where they're committing to creating a student task force on their campus to address sexual violence and create prevention, support, and advocacy programs. A part of the action plan was also evaluating campus sexual violence policies and highlighting gaps or shortcomings in various schools' policies. It began first at Carleton University when student activists or student advocates were trying to reform the policy at our local setting, and we felt like students weren't being properly consulted, that our voices weren't being heard. So we decided that we'd create an action plan for the student unions at Carleton. But then as we did more research, we realized that this was such a big issue and campuses across the country were all trying to tackle it. So we decided to expand it and make it national. And that's when the action plan moved to McGill and it was published by the Student Society of McGill University last week.
Cool. So so there are different schools that are signed on to this policy, and then you guys graded each campus policy. So can you speak to that grading process?
Of course. So as part of the advocacy section for the action plan, we created a set of 45 different criteria that students wanted to see in their policies. When student unions signed on, part of it was that they would go through the criteria or the scorecard that was created and work with us to evaluate their own scorecard or their own school's policy through the scorecard. So when the AMS from UBC decided to sign on to the action plan, we worked with one of their executive members to go through the policy and evaluate it. And UBC, actually, their policy was one of the higher ranked ones by the 45 criteria with a 78% or a B+.
Okay, interesting. So what is the action plan and how do you think that these action plans are going to actually impact campuses? And I guess what is kind of like the main kind of goal of these action plans?
So with the action plan for us, it's holistic. It's way beyond just looking at the sexual violence policies. For us, we know that this issue is is much broader than just the policies. From research, we know that around 90% of individuals who experience this won't come forward and won't report it. So a lot of important work has to be done on the prevention and support side. So with the action plan, when a student union commits, they're committing to creating a task force, running consultation meetings, doing a campus survey, and then looking at some of the other recommendations that we have and deciding what works on their campus. So for example, some campuses are creating sexual violence prevention training programs and linking it to club funding. Other campuses are looking into creating survivor networks or campus support networks and such. And it's been incredibly positive. We already have student unions who've committed across the country creating their task forces and starting to get work done on this issue.
Cool. So why is it so critical for students to be engaged in campus policies and I guess particularly sexual assault policies? What is kind of, the importance of having students have their input in these policies?
Well, we would argue that students are the primary stakeholders in this. For example, in Ontario, when the Ontario government passed Bill 132, which required all universities to create standalone sexual violence policies, they specifically included that students had to be consulted, just recognizing the important role that students must play. For students, it's not just that we are studying on campus. It's much more than that. We're living on campus. We're working on campus. It's our whole community. So when you experience harm, it can impact so many other facets of your life beyond just your study. So in terms of students needing to be consulted or needing to feel like their voices are heard, it's because they're the ones who are primarily impacted. And they're also the ones who are closest to the issue, at least on our campus. And as we traveled across the country meeting survivors and other students and allies, the main message was that students are primarily the ones who are receiving disclosures. Students are primarily the ones who are impacted by this. And it's not just faculty or administration who are having to deal with this issue. Every day we are. So we need to be involved in the process of creating these policies and creating prevention programs and the support networks and beyond.
So how has kind of the public reacted to Our Turn since it's come out? Because I understand that the actual product just came out recently, the document that you guys created. So have schools been pretty responsive to it? Have more schools kind of wanted to sign on to it? And kind of what are the next steps that Our Turn is taking? Are you guys going to be involved kind of in helping schools with their action plans? Or how do you guys see that going forward?
So the response has been pretty overwhelmingly positive. I think that when we were publishing the action plan, we were a little concerned. You know, when you're publishing a score on a university, it obviously can receive bad or negative responses. But for us, it's been incredibly positive. We've had members of institutions and administrations reach out to us and ask us questions. We've heard of schools that are currently creating, that are currently reviewing their sexual violence policies, that they've read the document and now they're taking into account some of the recommendations that are being made. And we also are having students from all over reaching out to us, and more student unions from different universities wanting to see if they can get involved. In terms of the future for Our Turn, we are looking at continuing to support universities or student unions as we move forward. So we will be continuing to have student unions sign on if they're interested and helping them with that process. And now as student unions are now creating their task forces, for us, we're developing resources for them. We have a ton of resources from some of the work that we are doing at McGill and at Carleton that we're able to share. And as we're going forward, we have volunteers or individuals who've been involved in this field for a long time who are going to help develop more resources as we go forward.
So if students at UBC are interested in kind of engaging with this initiative, how can they get involved
And what can students do to kind of take action on their campus in terms of sexual assault policies?
I would say, at least on UBC's campus, definitely reach out to the AMF. I believe that the AMF will be releasing. The AMF has committed to the action plan, and in the near future, they will be either creating a task force or starting to engage with students on this issue. For us, though, there's already so many groups on the ground doing this work, so I would say for also students to reach out to the individuals who have already started this work and continue supporting them. In terms of generally if students want to get involved in the policy or in the policy consultation, definitely go to meetings, definitely watch your emails and contact individuals of your administration, because we're at a point currently where a lot of universities are passing these policies or reviewing them, and it's really a critical time to get involved.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about our turn is that it really holds schools accountable to their policies, and it gives kind of like this national framework to sexual assault policies, which I think is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, has anything like this ever been done in other policy venues do you know of, or is this kind of like the first time that there's kind of been a national guide towards campus policy in general?
I'm really not sure about the campus policy, like other policies. I think that sexual violence policies are a very specific form of policies that are a very sensitive issue and almost like polarizing issue for a lot of people. In terms of, at least for this, when we were doing research, we really struggled to find any form of guidelines for universities. So for us, the point or the goal of this action plan is not solely to just criticize universities or criticize the policies. It's actually to kind of point out a gap that when the provinces are starting to require or have required universities to create these policies, there's a real lack of guidelines, so universities are really unsure as to where to go. For us, these recommendations or these criteria are just what students are hoping to have implemented in these policies, and it's a first step for universities to turn if they are unsure as to what to include and what not to include the policy.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So thank you so much for joining us, Caitlin, and I wish you guys all the best with the future of Archern, and we will definitely be keeping you guys updated on what is happening with the AMS in terms of what UBC is going to do about Archern. So yeah, thank you so much, Caitlin.
Thank you for having me.
Ciao.
Is that good, Alex?
Okay, so you are listening to UBC Happy Hour. You just heard Caitlin Salvino from Archern, which is a student-led initiative to grade campus sexual assault policies across the country. So yeah, if you want to check it out online, you can just Google Archern Action Plan and it'll come up right away. It's a PDF document. And so Archern's Action Plan recommendations are now in the hands of the AMS. So the AMS is still working through how they are planning on implementing the recommendations. We're looking forward to seeing how this will roll out, and we'll definitely be keeping you updated. So next up, we're going to be playing a track that was just released today, and we're so excited to be playing. So we're going to be hearing the track Prig from the band Gulo, which is a three-piece band comprised of UBC students Peter Zong on bass, Ben Beaver on drums, and friend of the show Mika Burlow on guitar and vocals. So Mika is part of Blank Vinyl Project, which is a campus music club who we have featured on the show in the past. And yeah, Mika and BVP have been such a great resource for sharing campus-made music with us. So you can thank him and BVP for all the wonderful music that we have played on this show. So here is Gulo with their track Prig.
Thank you. In the words of Henry David Thoreau, it's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see. Multicultural Ministries is a national, cross-Canada, non-profit organization that runs temple tours and gives unique perspectives into different religions from around the world, including Buddhism, Sikhism, and Islam. To find out more about them, the tours they offer, or to book one, please visit templetour.weebly.com.
Hey, did you know?
More than 4,500 Canadians are waiting for an organ transplant right now.
Right now. 4,500.
People are dying.
And you could save a life.
90% of Canadians say they're willing to donate their organs.
But only a few are registered.
So what are you waiting for?
Get registered.
It's easy and it's free.
Leave a legacy.
Be a hero.
Save a life.
Find out how to register today. Go to kidney.ca.
I have a right to safety, I have a right to education, I have a right to my culture. Kids like me need to know about child rights and earlier age what to do about it.
Today, the Canadian Council of Child and Youth Advocates asks you to make every day a day to stand up for children's rights in your life. If you are a young person who needs the help of an advocate, you can also find the advocate for your own province listed on ccdya.ca.
Tune in every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. for A Little Bit of Soul with your host, Jade Park. A Little Bit of Soul plays primarily old recordings of jazz, swing, big band, blues, oldies, and Motown.
You are listening to UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. So the first part of the show, we were talking to Ryan Patrick Jones about his piece on masculinity and consent and initiatives that are exploring these and opening up conversations about these topics on campus. And then I did an interview with Caitlin Salvino about the student-led initiative Our Turn, which graded campus sexual assault policies across the country. And then we just heard a track from the UBC band Gulo. They just released this track today. It's called Prig. It's one of our really good friends, Mika, who's part of Blank Vinyl Project. He's in the band, and we're really excited about the song. And then last up on the show, we sat down with Sally Lynn, who is the VP External of the AMS, the Alma Mater Society, here at UBC, to talk about the AMS campaign Rent with Rights, which is a campaign trying to secure tenant rights for students living on campus, and to kind of set a framework for these rights. So yeah, let's hear what this policy is all about.
So Sally, thank you so much for joining us on the show. So how about we start off with just what is AMS Rent with Rights?
Awesome. Thanks for having me, by the way. This is really great. So Rent with Rights is a campaign put on by your alma mater society, where we are advocating for student tenancy rights on campus. So what it looks like currently is under the Residence Tenancy Act, which is a piece of provincial legislation. It doesn't actually cover institutional housing, so on-campus student housing. So if you live in Gage, if you live in Ponderosa, it's not covered. And it means that students are left without rental rights protection. And then what it means is that any sort of guarantees that students do have, it's just based on a contract between you as an individual and the university. Oftentimes it could become quite one-sided because it's dictated by how the university sets its protocols.
What kind of are the current housing policies in place at UBC? So if a student is, you know, renting in first year, like Totem or Gage, what would kind of their contract look like?
I would essentially refer themselves back to the UPC housing, student housing and hospitality services housing contracts. They're all online, and so it basically posts out, you know, a resident, when you're moving into campus, you start from this date and you end on this date, basically, it sets around, like, all around that contract. That is your piece of paper that you get to look at and say, okay, these are the guarantees that I get. Anything else beyond that is essentially kind of, I would imagine them to be soft rules, so protocols set around in student housing. Like, you're expected to not start fires, not, you know, make a lot of noise, be respectful to your neighbors, but those aren't in the contract because they're smaller logistical things that aren't being addressed, and those are typically certain things that would be covered under an RTA. So they look at policies around, you know, keeping pets, like goldfishes, smaller ones, plants, safety, etc.
Okay, so how did Rent with Rights come to be?
So Rent with Rights itself as a movement really began in 2014. That was a year where there were a lot of policy changes and fee increases. So an example of that would be student housing prices for the winter session was increased by 20%. That was a huge price increase that negatively impacted a lot of students, and especially in the context of the affordability issue, where tuition prices are increasing, if rental prices are also increasing in a competitive Vancouver rental market, that puts students in a very, very unpleasant situation. And so what ended up happening is that students came to the AMS's AGM, the annual general meeting, and they indicated to the AMS that they wanted to see the Student Society take action on this. They wouldn't want to see extreme situations like the 20% rent increase ever happen again. So then the AMS, listening to our students, because that's what we want to be able to do, to hear our students' concerns and be able to act upon them, took this issue and looked at it more broadly as an issue around student tenancy rights. The VP Academic and University Affairs back then worked with her team to develop a set of recommendations that were given to Student Housing and Hospitality Services that would essentially add in some guarantees for students in their housing contracts, and setting up protocols that, such as like appeals boards, that basically help facilitate decision making and give students a better voice to be heard at the ground level on services, on like day-to-day life in student housing. Some of them were taken and some of them were not. So then the VP External Affairs before me actually took those recommendations, did more research. They looked at RTAs from other provinces, housing contracts from other post-secondary schools, and then developed a set of 9 recommendations that would fit into a piece of provincial legislation that could cover essentially just on-campus student housing. I guess, core belief or core principle behind this is essentially that we want to be able to make sure that there is recommendations going forward that addresses the unique environment of living on campus. It's essentially UBC, which is one landlord, having thousands upon thousands of student renters, and that relationship isn't going to work like any normal landlord versus renter relationship, and so it really needs to be covered by something unique, and that's what Rentworth Rights hopes to address, this unique relationship, and making sure that even though it is different than a regular rental relationship, that students are still being protected in this aspect.
Right. So I understand that SFU and UVic are also involved in the campaign. So what? Where did kind of that collaboration stem from?
So actually, quite luckily, the campaign actually saw much more support this year. So last year, we've engaged with SFU Student Society as well as UVic Student Society, which the AMS collaborates quite often with when we are doing advocacy to the government. These two student societies signed on to Rentworth Rights and also ran the campaign in tandem with us both last year and this year. And when we traveled to Victoria to speak to ministers, MLAs, and staff about these issues around student tenancy rights, they're at the table with us advocating for their students as well. And so Rentworth Rights has become something that started from UBC but become a movement that really encompasses post-secondary students from all across the province. This spring, actually, the Alliance of BC Students, which encompasses five other student societies as well, has also signed on to Rentworth Rights. So I might have the wrong number right now, but I think it covers about 160,000-180,000 students all across the BC province of student societies that represent these number of students. And so it's really grown in support, and I think it's only going to continue to grow in support from student societies moving forward, because more and more so they're starting to realize how crucial it is to address this issue and address the one-sided relationship that's currently being set up.
Yeah, it sounds like there's clearly, you know, a drive to have this kind of come to be. Like, it seems as though there's definitely a need for this on campuses, especially considering that so many other schools are kind of joining into this. Do you by any chance know if in other provinces they have something kind of regulated, or is this a pretty kind of unique campaign?
That's not the case. So for most provinces, they are likely also excluded. When they were doing the climate survey last year, they looked at, again, I said RTAs from all across different provinces, and not many of them are covered at all. The reason why this is a BC campaign is because post-secondary is a provincial jurisdiction. Advanced education is a provincial jurisdiction covered by the province and not the federal government, or else we'd be going to the federal government.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, so Rentworth Rights has a petition. So why is it necessary to have a petition? And so, yeah, what's kind of that aspect of, like, collectivity that makes this kind of campaign important?
Well, one of the advantages of students is that they are an eligible voter base. Like any reasoning behind any civic engagement is that when you go out and vote and when you go out and show your voice and show your and demonstrate your support in petitions and writing and letters to MLAs, it essentially flags the issues for the decision-making body and the decision-makers and says, hey, we are your constituents and we are here and we're important and this is something that we really want to be able to have. So make the change for us, and it creates an incentivizer for the decision makers, in this case legislators, to enact changes that benefit students. The AMS is in a position where we are able to do the research, we are able to provide data-driven and research-based advocacy and recommendations to the province to deliver on the how aspect, and where students come in and is key for the AMS and why we do the petition is that we want to be able to engage our students to make sure that they understand the issue, they know about it, and when they demonstrate the support, we can take that support to the province and say, hey, this isn't just the Student Society, this is actually all of our students too.
Yeah, so why should students care about this policy or, yeah, this kind of initiative? And who do you think on campus is, you know, affected by this policy?
I'd say anyone living in student housing would be affected. So if you are a student tenant, then you would be covered by this policy when you're living in institutional housing if this sort of change is enacted. And it really helps them in ways that are both minute to much more significant. So drawing from a couple of examples from our recommendations, one of them is a situation like the 20% rent increase. So essentially if the recommendations were adopted as is, then students would able to be guaranteed protection from insane rent increases. So drawing back to the very extreme example of the 20% rent increase in 2014, in our recommendations we put forward that rent increases should be no more than 2% per year tied to inflation, and so that creates consistencies and clarity around what students can expect when they're going to be living on campus. They're going to know that they're not going to go from 1 year paying $1,000 or so for a studio to paying like $1,500 for a studio, mm-hmm. because that's quite the jump in numbers. A very specific UBC example would be service delivery. So for example, students currently are paying full price to live on campus, even if, for example, a laundry room is broken down or is not completed with furnishing and they don't have access to it and need to use a laundry room from a different building. In a typical case covered under the RTA, the landlord would have to be accountable to this issue and provide means of compensation, whereas this currently isn't the case for students living on campus, and there's no sort of protocol or procedure set up to deal with it either. And so students essentially would be able to see more accountability, more clarity and consistency around what they can expect from student housing. And that's not to say that UBC is not doing it right, because Rent with Rights is something that is moved on past being just UBC specific and a movement that all student societies in BC, most student societies in BC are now supporting. An example from, I guess there are also examples where UBC is doing quite well in. For example, contracts in UBC list the exact start and end date of their contracts, so students know when they need to start looking for housing and when they need to move out, whereas in the UVic contract for their student housing, students don't know when their end date is, and it's decided based on their exam period, so they have to move out 24 hours after their last exam, when exam periods are already a really stressful time for students. They then don't know when they need to move out until closer to the exam period when the schedule is released, and they have to start thinking about everything all at the same time. So it really, there are like a lot of pros and cons between what different institutions are doing, but what this is able to do is provide at least a little bit of basis for consistency across the board, so students going from different schools have that same guarantee.
Right. So if Rent with Rights was passed, would it kind of standardize rental agreements on campuses in the province?
Not entirely, because like previously mentioned, because post-secondary environments are so unique and that institutions deal with a drastically different number of students. UBC has about 11,000 or more beds, whereas UVic or SFU and for commuter-based campuses like Kwantlen have much less students living on campus, and so how they manage and navigate that relationship is really different. What the legislation, the recommendations for the legislation seeks to do is to put in some guidelines that institutions can draw from. So there will be some basics, but a lot of it provides them with a time frame to address issues so that smaller institutions versus bigger institutions have that flexibility to navigate with their student populations.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, there are definitely so many variations across campuses. And UBC is kind of this like mini city.
Entirely.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that more kind of things like this are happening, because yeah, there's just like, so many people on this campus, and it's only growing and only increasing. Yeah. And so I think that having like policies and really kind of enforcing like good legislation that focuses on student benefits is really important. So if students want to get engaged in this campaign, how could they do so?
Well, one of the first things I would say is come and get to know what Rent With Rights is about. Students can visit rentwithrights.ca, which is a website that we've set up. It has information on everything that we do, our campaign progress, a petition sheet template, as well as the recommendations. And we actually go in and explain what each of the recommendations look like and kind of our inspiration from for developing these recommendations and what they mean.
Nice. And so where is Rent With Rights at right now, kind of in its trajectory, I guess you could say? Where does it kind of stand with the BC government?
So currently, we just have a huge turnover in government where the people who have come in are entirely new to their position. And so we had visited Victoria actually last month to speak to the ministers and MLAs for the first time on all the student issues and create an introduction to student societies here in BC. And one of the things that we brought to them is Rent With Rights, telling them what this is about, what is it like, how it might look like if it was enacted, and our progress, informing them about our progress on this as well. So I don't have a conclusive answer as to are they going to do it right away or not. But for us, it's always an iterative process. We're going to be bringing this to them to see what their thoughts are and looking at the ways in which we can collaborate with the government to make sure that students are being protected on campus.
Nice. How did that meeting in Victoria go?
Generally, it's been very positive. This government currently is very receptive to listening to the issues that students bring up. And we are actually doing two consultations with them on other issues. But they're very keen on knowing about the how we do things as student societies, how we interact with our students. And so I think there is a lot of room for exploring how Rent With Rights moves forward.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Thank you so much, Sally. And do you have any, I don't know, last words about Rent With Rights? Or?
No, I really don't have anything else. Thanks for having me. The last thing students can do is just visit the website. They can come and visit the AMS offices to sign the petition if they'd want to demonstrate their support, as well as myself and any of my staff are always available to chat about it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
So you are listening to UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard Sally Lin, who is the VP External of the Alma Mater Society here at UBC, speaking about Rent With Rights, which is a campaign designed to secure tenant rights for students renting on campus. So I'm Alex Lenz, and this is the UBC Happy Hour, a show that is all about campus happenings. UBC Happy Hour is collaboratively produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. So if you like what you heard and you want to contribute to this show, you can send us an email at ubcaffairs@citr.ca. And you can find all episodes of UBC Happy Hour podcasted online at citr.ca. So that's it for today, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you next week. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Free love on the free love freeway. The love is free and the freeway's long. I've got some hot love on the hot love highway. Ain't going home because my baby's gone. She's not dead.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, soundtracking your free love on the free love freeway since 1982.
Long time later, see a cowboy crying. Says, hey buddy, what can I do? Says, I lived a good life, about a thousand women. I said, well, why the tears? He says, because none of them was you. No, he's looking at a photograph.
Of you?
No, of his girlfriend. The video would have shown up, yeah.
It sounds a bit gay.
It's not gay.
strength,
dignity, respect,
beauty,
self-worth,
safety,
confidence,
choice,
hope.
The Beauty Night Society is a registered charity dedicated to helping marginalized women introduce trust, hope, and self-esteem into their lives.
This is the first day of... Through